Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
A lot of people will tell you the credit ratings agencies really helped the financial crisis get going, and not in a good way either. Today, the Justice Department seems to have agreed. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Make it a working lunch. Listen to the Marketplace Midday Update podcast for the day's top business headlines. Subscribe on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for the 4th of February. It's a Monday, and we begin with a stock quote. Ticker symbol MHP, the McGraw-Hill Companies Incorporated. Off almost 14% at the close, and you can blame it all on McGraw-Hill's subsidiary, the credit ratings agency Standard & Poor's. There are reports today that the Department of Justice and a whole mess of state attorneys general as well are set to file suit, perhaps this week, charging S&P with fraudulently rating mortgage bonds in the lead-up to the financial crisis. Evan Perez is covering the story for the Wall Street Journal. Evan, it's good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you.
I don't know if anybody's checked the calendar, but it's been now 5 years since the financial crisis really got going. Where have the Justice Department been on this?
It's a very good question. It's a question that has been asked repeatedly, and it seems like nobody is paid for what happened in 2007 and 2008 with the collapse of the financial markets. So that's been something that the Justice Department, I think, has felt a lot of pressure on. They haven't been able to bring any criminal charges, in part because they say a lot of the behavior that brought the financial crisis was risky and stupid, but perhaps not illegal. Yeah. So instead, what they've been pursuing is trying to figure out how to bring civil charges, which is what they're doing with S&P.
Why S&P only? As you said, there were a bunch of other rating firms out there giving these things AAAs as well.
I think this is what we'll hear is that the Justice Department is still looking at the other firms. They started the S&P inquiry earlier than they did others. And so this, I think, is the beginning of what you might see a wider effort.
The traditional defense for the ratings companies the past couple of years when these kinds of cases have been brought by other people has been First Amendment defense, that they have the right to say whatever they like about the status of these bonds. Where's that going to go? Because that's just fascinating, right?
Well, yes, that's interesting. I mean, it's also what the Justice Department, I think's view is, you know, your First Amendment is fine, but if you are proposing that certain bonds have a AAA rating, and you're selling these services based on this idea that, you know, that you know what you're talking about. So I think their allegation is that there was some fraud involved in this.
If I'm your average homeowner out there, is this of interest to me other than sheer news value?
Well, I mean, it does appear that, you know, around the country, you do have this sentiment that what happened in 2007 and 2008 has not been punished, that the government hasn't done enough, and that this could happen again. I think the Justice Department, I think, is trying to make the point that, indeed, you know, they're on the ball on this.
What has S&P said about this so far today?
Well, they say the action is without merit, that they're going to fight these charges. And I think, you know, this is going to be tested. I think I don't know that we know how this is going to turn out.
Evan Perez at the Wall Street Journal. Evan, thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
All right, two more things about this story before we move on. One, S&P parent company McGraw-Hill is itself a subsidiary, in this case of Warren Buffett's firm, Berkshire Hathaway. Also, from the New York Times, this tidbit that prosecutors could be seeking $1 billion or more in damages. McGraw-Hill's profits last year, $911 million. So that's not going to work out too well. Speaking of nice big numbers, we turn now to the stock market. The Dow Industrial spent most of last week dancing around the 14,000 mark. The S&P 500 and the NASDAQ were doing fine as well. Small investors who'd largely bailed out of stocks during the financial crisis started gingerly returning after weeks of encouraging economic and corporate news. And then today, the Dow's first triple-digit loss of the year. Marketplace's Mark Garrison looked into why jitters continue even as apparently good news abounds.
You know it's rough when an investment club stops investing. That's in large part what happened in recent years at Gene Center's Dayton, Ohio club. Last year, stocks accounted for only around half their roughly $100,000 portfolio. But at their meeting last month, they added a large batch of stocks.
We decided that we are investors and we wanted to be in there because you're not getting anything with cash.
And there's evidence more Americans are doing the same thing, moving away from safe but low return spots like money market funds. Mutual fund tracking firm Lipper says stock funds have taken in more than $20 billion this year. But that's tip money compared to what people took out in recent years, often at a loss.
They got crushed in the crisis, and they just have not come back into there.
Lipper's Tom Rosine adds many investors also got mixed up in the dot-com meltdown.
Really, I think people were burned, and they've been burned twice in a decade.
Washington State University finance professor John Nofsinger studies investor psychology. No matter how much media hype kicks up around a rising market, it's not enough to distract investors from what's happening in their lives.
People still know friends or relatives that are either out of work or trying to get a better job, those kinds of things. And so we're still a little cautious, but now we're at least positive cautious.
Positive cautious is a far cry from enthusiastic, but that may be all the market can ask for from ordinary Americans whose retirement savings have been battered. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
I'd say they were negative cautious in equities today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's a fundamental truism of online shopping that pretty much every click you make is tracked, and that the data you hand over, knowingly or not, helps e-tailers learn more about you and your likes and your dislikes. They can then recommend specific products, give you personalized deals, and sell you more stuff. It's a pretty nice competitive advantage over regular stores, but that same tracking thing has now started happening offline as well, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith explains.
Forget infinity scarves and jewel-toned pants. The real cutting-edge retail trend right now is in-store cameras. Of course, being monitored while you shop is nothing new, but these are not your run-of-the-mill security cameras.
What that does is a partial facial recognition. It takes cheeks, chin, eyes, and basically gets gender and age.
At the National Retail Federation trade show in New York City, Brian Kirilly shows off a camera his company, Infusion, developed with Microsoft. It's recording people in the area, including me, and a software program is sorting them in real time by age, child, adult, or senior, and gender. It's projecting the results on a giant screen.
Wait a minute, does it think I'm a man?
It possibly does.
This camera isn't designed to catch shoplifters. It's gathering data to help stores improve sales. Brick-and-mortar stores are hungry for all the information they can get on their customers, the kind of information online retailers have. So many are trading security cameras in for smart cameras.
We can actually look at your movement on how you go from a merchandise table in the front up the escalator or not. We can do dwell time. How long did you stay in a specific area?
Roseanne McCulley is with Experian, one of the big three credit report agencies. It recently launched a smart camera business that's being used by retailers like Lacoste and Adidas. McCulley says stores have used data from the smart cameras to change what they stock and where they put it. That's resulted in customers spending 5% more at those stores. And that number could grow as retailers find new ways to step up shopper surveillance.
The next wave of technology is mobile.
Experian is teaming up with cell phone companies to take customer tracking to the next level. When you walk into a participating store, your cell phone company will tell Experian who you are. Experian will tap into the vast pool of data it has on you, things like age and credit history. McCulley says without telling stores who you are, Experian will hand some of that information over to them.
There's all sorts of privacy issues around cell phone data, so no one is able to take a cell phone number and bring it to a person. But what we can do is profile groups of people and give people a demographic code.
Experian will assign shoppers one of 60 consumer profiles, such as Dreamweaver, people with six-figure salaries and a penchant for tech gadgets, or another type of shopper called struggling city center, people on tight budgets who tend to like watching talk shows. Experian and cell phone company Verizon are both piloting programs that could tell retailers even more.
Through wireless technology, you can get the pattern of the person when they left the house, drove to the mall, and the stores they went to.
We are moving into a world where companies are going to judge us by our data.
Joseph Thoreau is a professor at the University of Pennsylvania's Annenberg School for Communication.
We will have people being put into what I call reputation silos, which would tell the story this person is more likely to buy the cheap stuff, and here's the person who buys the premium stuff.
If you're suddenly feeling the urge to wear a ski mask everywhere and ditch your phone, you're having exactly the reaction retailers are worried about, says digital marketing consultant Will Riegel.
Every single day, people in data are concerned about the creep factor.
Riegel says one way to target shoppers without freaking them out is to use loyalty programs, where customers essentially volunteer to have their purchases tracked in exchange for relevant discounts. The next stage would be to embed a tracking chip in, say, your Target card.
When you walk into a store, an in-store advertisement will adjust to say, hey, you haven't picked up Tide recently. It's been over a month. Your clothes getting a little dirty? Check out aisle number 7.
Kind of like in the futuristic movie Minority Report. When Tom Cruise walks into stores, they recognize him, and an avatar addresses him personally.
Welcome back to the Gap. How those assorted tank tops work out for you?
Of course, that's at least a few years away. For now, as I learned at the National Retail Federation show, cameras are still trying to separate girls from boys, which is apparently much easier if you take your hair out of a bun.
It's adjusting. Refresh. Woman, see?
Woohoo! In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Ever since the Great Recession started, more than 5 years ago now, we've all been paying closer attention to how we bring in that paycheck every couple of weeks. But the truth is, the American labor market started changing long before the financial crisis. So today we're going to start a new series. It's called Disappearing Jobs.
My name is Lee Sanders. For the last 40 years, I've been a motion picture projectionist, a film projectionist. A friend of mine who was managing a sleazy little theater called the Vagabond Theater said, our projectionist just quit. Go in there and run it. And I didn't care about getting paid. I just wanted to go in there and do it. So for $3.50 an hour, I went in there and taught myself. And then I found a stable union job. And I was told by my older peers that I could probably keep this job forever. I would never have to retire because it didn't require physical labor, it just required your know-how on the equipment. Everybody in America went to the movies every week, so we were important. That was the year also that a projectionist was listed as the highest paid industrial job in California. I like to remind people of that now that they're trying to pay us nothing. They go to movies for years and they never know I'm there or doing anything. I'm totally invisible unless something goes wrong. You know, I was handling some 16mm film and I realized if I repair this right and run it right on my own projector, I can run it forever. It will never wear out. I just have to do it right. My favorite quote is still the studio executive who said, we have a robust system and we can pay any idiot $5 an hour to run it. So why away with the film projectors. Anyway, the reason is everybody loves new technology and now they have it. Sorry we couldn't keep it together, but we had a good long run from almost the entire century. I still intend to be the last projectionist alive. My friends are ready for this, but the industry is not cooperating. It'll be a real accident if I get more jobs.
Lee Sanders is, or was, I guess, a film projectionist here in Los Angeles. There's more from our Disappearing Jobs series on our website, including some of the fastest shrinking jobs in the country. And while you're there, tell us if your job is disappearing. Marketplace.org is the website. Coming up.
Teachers are so important. Teachers are the critical lever in student achievement. If we're serious about this, let's pay them what they're worth.
Six figures, in fact. But first, let's do the numbers. Yeah, see you later, 14,000. The Dow Industrials sank 129 points today, 0.9%, closed at 13,880. The Nasdaq surrendered 47 points, about 1.5%, finished at 31.31. The S&P 500 fell 17 points, 1.1%, closed at 14.95. Renewed concerns about the European debt crisis spooked traders, hitting bank stocks especially hard. Morgan Stanley withdrew 2.75%. Bank of America shares off nearly 2% today. Citigroup debited 1.9% today. Tech companies had kind of a mixed day. Software giant Oracle gave back 3% after announcing plans to buy the telecommunications equipment maker Acme Packet. Shares of Acme Packet rocketed 23% higher. That might be the best company name ever, by the way. Netflix picked up about 6%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.95%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Get Marketplace's top headlines, podcasts, and special features delivered right to your inbox each day. Subscribe to the Midday Update newsletter at Marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the House Judiciary Committee discusses America's immigration system. A look at the assets in the Mouse Kingdom, including the recently acquired Death Star, Disney reports quarterly earnings, and let's take a moment to appreciate the weather forecast. It's instrumental in helping you pick your shoes or decide whether you can barbecue or go camping for people who do that sort of thing. It's National Weather Person's Day. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. All right, now that all is said and done, the game's been played, 150 million of us watched, and companies spent untold millions on television ads. A lot of what's in the air today is a tweet, a spur-of-the-moment, opportunistic even, tweet from the good people at Oreo, pointing out that you can still dunk in the dark. Seemed like a whole lot of sound and fury for a single tweet to be the thing that lingers. So we called up Ben Winkler. He's at OMD. That's an ad agency in New York City. Ben, welcome to the program.
Thanks very much.
So is this where we are now that major corporate brands like Oreo or you know, your client Pepsi have to, during these big events, have like a war room staffed with response teams and everything?
Yes. If they are interested in being relevant to today's consumer who's expecting all media to be interesting and about them, then yes, 100%, absolutely.
Well, take me inside that room. I mean, how do you think it went as the lights went out and the Oreo people said, man, we had an ad on the air and now let's back it up with social media?
Oh, yeah. Every player that you would ever need through the course of, say, a six-week ad campaign was sitting in that room, from legal to PR, obviously client approval, creative guys. It takes an enormous investment to get them all there and aligned so that they can respond this quickly. And they were only there, of course, because Oreo had spent $4 million in putting an ad on during the game.
Okay, now riddle me this. Do you think the tweet about you can still dunk after dark and the 13, 15,000 retweets or whatever it was, did that help sell any more Oreos today?
Without a doubt.
You think so?
Oh, without a doubt. But keep in mind, it's not the 15,000 retweets itself. It's the novelty of the fact that it got 15,000 retweets. It's the amplification effect from all the media like ourselves right now talking about this. 15,000 retweets pales next to 111 million people who saw the TV commercial or who watched the Super Bowl. So this is really lightning in a bottle. To expect that doing this again will automatically have this kind of impact is not the right lesson to take away from it.
Well, help me out then. The right lesson is?
This is hard to do, and it needs to be done all the time. Oreo, in this case, has been tweeting and posting pop culturally relevant messages for 6 months, since June, every single day of the week.
Do you have a favorite ad from last night?
You know, I have to, of course, say that the Pepsi Next ad was my favorite.
Of course it was. But maybe your second favorite?
Sure.
Well, I think that says something right there, man.
Yeah.
Right?
Wow. Yeah. This is the problem with watching a Super Bowl when you're a media professional. It's just like comedians watching comedy. Nothing's funny.
Does it take the charm out of it for you?
A little, yeah. It's a busman's holiday.
A little bit. Ben Winkler is the chief digital officer at the ad agency OMD in New York City. Ben, thanks a bunch.
Thanks a lot, Kai.
I'll be honest with you and admit that when I first heard what I'm about to tell you, I didn't quite believe it, but true it was. McDonald's, it seems, has a new menu item. It's called Fish McBites. And reading straight from the container now, here's what they are. Pieces of poppable Alaskan pollock. You can get them for grown-ups or in a Happy Meal. Or you can listen to Eve Tro from the Sustainability Desk tell you more about McDonald's seafood strategy.
McDonald's added its first non-hamburger item in the 1960s. Try our Filet-O-Fish, just one bite and you're hooked. The Filet-O-Fish was invented to lure Catholics who didn't eat meat on Fridays. So it's no surprise Fish McBites are debuting near the start of Lent. Fish has never outsold burgers at McDonald's, but when it comes to the seafood industry...
They're one of the largest buyers of fish in the United States.
Carrie Coughlin with the Marine Stewardship Council says all McDonald's fish is Alaskan pollock. Her group just certified it as sustainable, meaning fishing boats don't catch too much too fast.
Ensuring that they will have a supply of fish to keep that business going.
In addition to the green halo, fish gives McDonald's another reputation boost. With moms, says marketing analyst Maria Bailey, especially younger ones.
Millennial moms like to have their children have a broader range of flavors and tastes in their diet.
They might see a McBites Happy Meal as a way to introduce the fish flavor, she says. And these younger moms tend to be more conscious of health. Sure, it's battered, fried fish, but compared to the pink slime beef thing, well...
They want to keep their children safe, and fish seems like a safer route.
A Fish McBites Happy Meal has 135 calories less than a cheeseburger meal. Of course, if you pick up another seasonal item on the menu, the perennial favorite, the Shamrock Shake, probably negates any health savings. I'm Eve Tro from Marketplace.
Nobody ever said being a public school teacher was going to make you rich, which is why a public charter school in New York City that's paying its teachers doctor or lawyer money is worth a look. Since it opened 4 years ago, it's been part of an experiment to see whether paying top teachers top dollar can lead to a better education. Marketplace's Dan Bobkoff reports.
It started with a Facebook post. Kristen Van Olefen was teaching music in New Jersey when a friend posted about a new middle school offering some eye-popping salaries.
And I said, who gets paid $125,000?
After a few years and a grueling hiring process, Van Olefen can now say she does. The school is called the Equity Project Charter School, or TEP for short. Most of its students are low income and from the Washington Heights neighborhood, not the type of school where you'd expect six-figure teachers. So why $125,000?
Candidly, it was the maximum amount that would keep our budget in the black.
Zeke Vanderhook is TEP's founder and principal, and he's out to prove a couple of things. That if you've got great teachers, little else matters, and you can afford them, even on a public school budget.
It's saying, wow, teachers are so important. Teachers are the critical lever in student achievement, in student growth. If we're serious about this, let's pay them what they're worth.
But that has its own costs. For now, TEP is just a group of red trailers. The kids walk outside between periods.
I'm gonna send you, by the way.
There are no small classes. There's no laptop on every desk. Sure, Vanderhook hopes the school moves to a better building someday. But to him, what matters is having top teachers in the classroom. So that's where the money goes. In Kristen Van Olefen's music class, there are also lessons in vocabulary and math. Van Olefen also administered state achievement tests. That's part of the secret to the high pay. Most teachers have, in effect, two jobs.
Yes, I'm the 8th grade math teacher / assistant principal.
This is Casey Ash. He's been at TEP since it opened 4 years ago. The school saves money by not hiring the kind of support staff other schools have. There are no substitutes. That makes for long, demanding days.
I don't think it's the right fit for everybody.
There were a lot of expectations for us.
Before she came to TEP, Judy Lefebvre spent most of her teaching career in Arizona. And while she was highly regarded, the pay was lousy.
After 30 years, I was still making just over $40,000.
During the year-long interview process, she was observed in the classroom several times. Many TEP applicants submit videos of their teaching or samples of student work showing major improvements. Lefebvre was finally hired to teach special education and serve as the dean of discipline. But she soon found that her Arizona skills weren't as effective with students in New York. After her first year, she wasn't asked back.
I think the big unanswered question is, gee, what would have happened that second year now that I had those skills and had made that improvement?
But for TEP principal Zeke Vanderhook, there's no time to wait. Teachers must bring their A game on day one or else.
We give our master teachers 1 year to prove themselves.
Teachers are judged on classroom management and student test scores. They're also evaluated by other teachers. Vanderhook says about a quarter of them don't make it to the second year.
I'm a little worried about the sustainability of the model.
Michelle Fine is a professor of psychology and urban education at the City University of New York.
They might in fact be getting highly qualified educators, but either they're burning out or it's not working very well or they're dissatisfied.
The teachers I spoke with at TEP acknowledge the stress, but they insist it's worth it and they commend the quality of their colleagues. Fine says she doesn't expect the school to become a national model, even though it may work well for this one community in Washington Heights. This spring, the school's first class of eighth graders graduate on to high school. In a few years, we'll know better if their highly paid teachers have a lasting effect on their lives. I'm Dan Bobkoff for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, which comes with the observation that the price of a barrel of crude oil has been rising for two straight months, eight consecutive weeks. The Energy Department said today the average American household now spends $2,900 a year on gas, just under 4% of household income, the most we spent on gas in 30 years. It's all about the cost of efficiency, really. Even though our cars get more miles per gallon, we're driving more. Oh, that and gas is expensive, too. All right, we're done. That's Marketplace from APM. Our producers include Bridget Bodner, Nancy Fargali, Millie Jefferson, John Ketchum, Megan Larson, Jolie Podokas, Mary Dew, and Chow Tu. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll meet you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.